This BizNews production is brought to you by Brenthurst Wealth, South Africa's leading boutique wealth manager. Trusted to guide families for over 20 years. Invest better with Brenthurst.
All the way from the United States of America via Hermanus, I'll quickly give a little introduction. He's been at the front lines of South Africa's most significant battles. You think about this. The fight for energy and the fight for integrity. Most of us know André de Ruyter as a man who took on the impossible job at Eskom, facing down cartels, surviving a poisoning attempt, and then writing a book that shook the establishment. But before that, before he was navigating the corridors of power at Megawatt Park, he was navigating the complexities of global business in another superpower, China. For years, as a senior executive at Sasol, which many of us forget, he spent a significant amount of time in China working to develop coal-to-liquid fuel projects. It was a world of intense negotiation, cultural diplomacy, and immense technical challenges far from the South African public eye. That experience, managing massive projects in a tightly controlled environment, provided a unique training ground for the immense pressures that he later faced at Eskom. He's not just a man who saw the inner workings of state capture. He's a global executive who's operated at the highest levels in vastly different and equally demanding environments. And now he's operating in academia at the very, very top of the academic world. Please welcome a man whose story is more international and complex than you might ever imagine, André de Ruyter.
I guess the first thing for me to do is to reassure all of you that I'm not here to switch off the lights. I will, in fact, be making a speech, and hopefully the lights will stay on. It's also, Alec, thank you very much, an honor to be here in Fikile Mbalula's stead. I'm not sure if he will regard it as an honor that I am his substitute, but there you go. So South Africa is in crisis. Right? Our economy shows no sign of meaningful growth. Investor confidence is shrinking. Our currency is beleaguered. Government debt is ballooning to unsustainable levels. Our relationship with the United States has taken a significant turn for the worse. Geopolitical forces beyond our control force us to find new markets due to our traditional markets being increasingly constrained by tariff and non-tariff trade barriers. Civil unrest is destabilizing our cities and our towns. I was just chatting to the mayor outside. There was a minor civil upset in Stanford just before the flower show, which he had to handle. So it is everywhere. It's not just in Gauteng. Political murders are an all-too-frequent event. A Gini coefficient of 0.66 makes us the most unequal country in the world. And there's a growing sense of gloom and desperation, particularly among the poorest of the poor. Crime, problem that is pervasive, is becoming increasingly violent. Prominent activists, lawyers are murdered, apparently with impunity. Senior police officers make startling disclosures about political interference in their work and the misuse of the police for political ends. There are dark rumors of plots and coups even, and the military seem to grow restive under the yoke of civilian control. And sadly, our talented young people see little chance of making their future in this country and are headed in ever greater numbers for more stable and lucrative destinations. In the process, depriving South Africa of much needed talent for growing our economy. Policies that have been in place for decades appear not to be working and are increasingly rejected by our former allies of our government, but also investors are questioning whether we are on the right track. And significant sections of our population share this view. Factories are shutting down, employment is rising, and is now double the rate that it was a decade ago. Now, if you think that I'm talking about 2025, you're sadly mistaken. I'm talking about 1989, which is exactly when these conditions prevailed. The picture that I've painted was the one that immediately preceded the end of apartheid. And in some way, that may give us hope, because it means that we can pull back from the brink once again. But if you cast your mind back, the Berlin Wall had just fallen, and it was clear that South Africa could no longer get a free pass based on its opposition to communism. If W. de Klerk had taken over as president in February 1989, a real hospital pass if ever you wanted to have one. So what does he do? What does he do? He considers alternative options. He looks at how can he deliver on his duty as a leader. And it's a tough task. But if W. de Klerk is a smart man, and he understands the global situation very clearly. He knows that South Africa cannot continue with its racial policies. And he understands that the security forces can no longer keep a lid on civil unrest. But most of all, he understands that continuing on the path of his predecessors is economically unsustainable. The deficit is spiraling out of control. The 1986 debt standstill has inflated the cost of government debt to unaffordable levels. Inflation is precipitously high, and the governor of the Reserve Bank is raising interest rates to a real pain point. Those of you who had home loans at that time will remember that. So what does de Klerk do? He knows from P.W. Botha's disastrous Rubicon speech that continuing with South Africa's past policies simply will not be accepted, either locally or internationally. And thumbing your nose at your international partners simply is not an option. So what does he do? Instead of doubling down, as the hardliners in his cabinet want him to do, he opts for the only course of action he considers realistically open to him. Not only does he do the necessary thing, he does the right thing. Now, something that's not widely known is that only four of F.W. de Klerk's 18 cabinet members backed him when he made that speech. So he was a brave man. He walked out there and put himself on the line as a leader. And we all know what happened on that epoch-making day on the 2nd of February 1990. Released Nelson Mandela and other political prisoners, unconditionally unbanned the ANC, and negotiations for a democratic South Africa commence. Hugely important day. And the consequences, in spite of what the scaremongers predict, are not that catastrophic at all. On the contrary, the stock market ticks up, the rand wobbles a bit, but by the end of the year, it's back to the level that it was at the beginning of the year. Investor confidence increases. Very importantly, bond yields go down. In other words, the cost of government debt comes down as well. So that's a good sign. And in a whites-only referendum, an overwhelming majority of voters support de Klerk's initiative. Again, bearing in mind that this was a leader who walked in front, not knowing whether his followers would follow. So, bold, bold step. Now, of course, there's significant turbulence. You all know what happened at CODESA 1 and CODESA 2. But a new constitution is successfully negotiated. The ANC comes to power in 1994 in a peaceful transition, one of the very few peaceful handovers of power, remarkable, South African miracle. And then, remarkably, we enter a period of prosperity. It doesn't seem that way, but it actually was if you look at the numbers. We have economic growth, we have job creation, we have investment, and a significant improvement in our fiscal situation thanks to the careful stewardship of the economy by Thabo Mbeki and Trevor Manuel. So things turn around quite quickly, and they look good. But there are two shadows cast over the future of South Africa. The one is that an estimated 300,000 people die due to AIDS denialism, one of the great tragedies of democratic South Africa, and the rough beast of rampant corruption slouches towards Polokwane to be born. And if we then fast forward to 2025, I hope you'll agree that we have seen exactly the same situation play out that prevailed in 2025. The parallels are actually remarkable. Our state has been hollowed out by corruption and incompetence, rampant criminality, unsustainably high national debt. We've got uncontrolled government expenditure and waste. We've got corruption that seems to rear its head everywhere, like Hydra. And the party of the people, the party of the poor, proposes to raise VAT by 2 percentage points, in spite of the fact that they subsequently claimed credit for proposing it. But it was an ANC decision. So the lost decade of Jacob Zuma has been extended by another 7 years. And that's telling. It's 17 years where we've been in the doldrums without a clear direction. And the scoreboard tells a very sorry tale of what we are achieving. So the way that SONAs are drafted in the South African government, and I've been party to giving inputs into SONAs, is you asked as the chief executive or the director general to write a couple of paragraphs, and then you submit it, and then the union buildings that gets put into a great machine, and somewhere out pops a SONA, which may or may not contain the input that you've contributed as an official. Now, as this process unfolds, and it's already started, as this process unfolds, what will Cyril Ramaphosa say when he rises to greet his fellow South Africans when he makes the SONA 2026? What is he going to say? Is he going to double down on policies that have seen catastrophic increase in unemployment, capital flight, greater inequality than prevailed at the end of apartheid? Now, there are parts of the ANC that are working to effect a meaningful course correction. These positive initiatives are undermined by a complex resistance emanating from ideology, corruption, criminal interests. And the president, driven by the need to maintain consensus in his party, is shocked by the sorry state of affairs. He is shocked. But he can no longer point the finger of blame at others. So what will he do? Does he indulge in quiet quitting? Or does he wait for the axe to fall at the next ANC conference and quietly go off into the sunset? Or does he seize the moment? Does he, in a single speech, transform his legacy from an office holder who presided over the fall of South Africa to the leader who pivoted South Africa into a new direction of non-racialism, growth, job creation, and prosperity? What does he do? Quite a choice to make. So imagine, if you will, and I've had a bit of time to think over this, imagine, if you will, a fantasy SONA. Right? What would have the same impact that F.W. de Klerk had in 1989. What does that look like? What if he announces a means-tested economic empowerment mechanism aimed at the poorest of the poor, but without any racial component? Instead of the largesse doled out to politically connected in BE deals, Let's address inequality through economic empowerment of those who need it most. Given our nation's pervasive inequality, the majority, the vast majority of beneficiaries of such a policy will be black anyway. So we will still achieve the objective, but without racializing the policy. The beneficiaries will therefore benefit based on not their race, but on their need. Now, the 100 or so oligarchs who, according to Professor William Gumede, have shared R1 trillion between them will no doubt howl in protest, as will those who still wait their turn at the trough. But isn't this the best way to confound the critics of our policies? Isn't this the way to pull the rug out from President Trump by pursuing a policy that still achieves your objectives, but without racializing matters? So instead of crying treason, let's do something about fixing the problem by removing the racial sting. What better way to respond to punitive 30% tariffs than by making a bold counterproposal while at the same time addressing our nation's most needful constituency, who, let's face it, have seen little, if any, of the benefits of BEE? Now, let me just pause here to acknowledge that this is not my idea. This is an idea that I think, as far as I can establish, was first mooted by Dr. Anthea Jeffries. But it's still a great idea, right? It still, I think, makes enormous sense for us to implement it. But this fantasy sona can go further. Let the president announce a Chapter 9 successor to the Scorpions, properly budgeted and resourced, to go after corruption wherever it's found. Tell us who will succeed Shamila Batoy. Announce a moratorium for the next 10 years on the requirement for equity empowerment deals for all investments in gross fixed capital formation. And if you just do a simple internal rate of return calculations, and those in this room will know how that works, if you have a 25% free carry that you have to attribute to non-valuating shareholders, you raise your hurdle rate by an equivalent percentage. And what that means is that the number of feasible and attractive investable projects become less and less. As the curve goes out in terms of returns, the number of projects that make that hurdle rate become fewer and fewer. So by just doing that, we de-risk the investment climate for people coming in either from abroad or domestically to invest. Suddenly, mines, factories, infrastructure projects, many more of these will become attractive investments. Commit to the independence of the Reserve Bank. Remove all doubt on that score. Commit to fiscal prudence. Commit government departments and SOEs to zero-based budgets. It is clear that there is a lot going on in the budgeting process that is far from ideal. Cut the size of cabinet. I was referring to de Klerk's cabinet, 18 ministers. How many do we have today? Probably the size of this room, but it's big. Deregulate and stop state-owned enterprises from investing in projects where they crowd out the private sector with government-guaranteed funds. Let the private sector invest and take risks as appropriate. So state entrepreneurship, that contradiction in terms, I think, has reached the end of the road. And as for our foreign policy, well, stay non-aligned if you must, but get the army out of the arms of America's enemies. I can tell you from my engagements in Washington, it does not play well. And it's not only Trump and Trump supporters who criticize this. It is universally frowned upon in Washington. People are concerned about the rapprochement between South Africa and the enemies of the United States. Don't praise Zimbabwean land grabs as ambitious reforms. Commit to protecting property rights. Follow due process where expropriation is necessary, as it sometimes is. Denounce Kill the Boer. I mean, why would you not do that? There's no real reason why not. Announce a properly appointed ambassador to Washington and point to these reforms as a reason why tariffs should be lowered and AGOA safeguarded. Now, we won't do this to appease Trump. We won't. It's no skin off our nose. It will cost us nothing, as a matter of fact. But the benefits are enormous. The payoff is huge. Look at the results that Javier Milei has achieved in Argentina. Now, it's maybe a bridge too far to wish for a chainsaw revving up in the union buildings. I can't quite see that happening. But maybe just a little dose of that libertarian medicine will do us a power of good to get rid of the notion that the state should control everything. I think we should reconsider racial quotas for jobs. The demographics of our population, and if I look across this room, it confirms my hypothesis. We will transform regardless, just based on demographic trends. White people are getting older and fewer. We need to persuade the best and brightest of our population to come back to South Africa and to contribute to the country, regardless of their race. So if we assume, which is obviously not true, that all South African employers are incredibly racist and they only appoint white people, if the economy grows at 5%, and I've actually done the math, it is a matter of months based on normal labor absorption rates, when all the whites that can possibly look for a job are employed. And you have to transform, even if you do not want to, which of course is not the case. So there's a real opportunity here to focus on growth as the first priority, second priority, and third priority. Grow, 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 because that solves almost all of our problems. The answer is not more regulation, more racial quotas, more forced ideological interventions in the economy. No. We've got to remove every impediment imaginable to enable the economy to perform to its potential. And transformation will follow, as it must. But it won't be a zero-sum game. We will share in the benefit of a growing economy. Now, year after year, Alec, I know you're a regular attendee at Davos, and year after year, Team South Africa go there with their nice yellow scarves around or their nice flag scarves around their necks. And every year they say, it's business unusual in South Africa. Now, like those scarves, that story is becoming threadbare. People don't believe us anymore. We need to come up with a narrative that is compelling and that delivers on market-friendly reform, not the National Democratic Revolution. So I would say that really for the Honorable President, SONA 2026 really is the last opportunity for business unusual. The country cannot afford more prevarication and procrastination and commissions. We now need to deliver. We now need to perform. Unleash the economy. Unleash private enterprise to prevent us from tumbling over the edge. The president has 5 months to write a speech that will change the course of our nation, I'm convinced, if he follows this outline. And he can secure his legacy as a leader who finally stepped up to lead when South Africa needed it most. Thank you very much.
This BizNews production is brought to you by Brenthurst Wealth, a multi-award-winning, truly independent boutique wealth manager. Invest better with Brenthurst.